From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour news show in which we talk about, the news. And I have with me today Patrick Michaels, a staff writer of The Observer.
Hi.
I also have with us Melissa Del Bosque, another staff writer at The Observer.
Hello.
And joining us for the first time in a while is Dave Mann, editor of the Texas Observer. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's great to be here.
Good. I'm glad you're here. We're going to start with a story about a lethal injection drug controversy. Patrick, I believe you're going to fill us in.
Sure. So we've been hearing for a while that Texas was running out of the drugs that it used to carry out the death penalty here. And as recently as last summer, it sounded like the TVCJ was pretty much out of the drugs that it had. And then in September, miraculously, they managed to execute another prisoner. And so there's a lawsuit on October 1st from the next guy in line for execution, saying that, you know, he and other prisoners had been hearing some rumors about where these drugs were coming from. And you know, if they come from these sort of, they're called compound pharmacies, pharmacies where the drugs are made for order, made to order, that there were all kinds of problems with those. And they sued to find out basically, you know, where the drugs were coming from, was part of the lawsuit. And so the records came out just recently as to where these were coming from. It was a pharmacy in the Woodlands, where the pharmacist was shocked to find out that his name was going to be put out there as the source of the drugs. When the inmate, was executed on Wednesday, but the storm is still kind of brewing around this, and, the pharmacist has asked for the drugs to be returned to him. The state's saying no, they won't do that. Another pharmacy in Chicago that had also supplied some drugs to the state said, well, you know, if our name's going to be out there, we don't want our names associated with this either. They asked for their drugs back as well, and Texas said no to that too. So there's kind of an open question of, is anyone going to supply these drugs to the state of Texas again to carry out lethal injections, or, you know, are we going to have to figure out something else?
This is a real problem because I think some of the big drug companies that have made these drugs for a long time are European, and they didn't want the drugs being used for the death penalty, and so they had cut off American states that were using it for lethal injection, and now you get these small pharmacies are the ones that are supplying it, and I imagine that whoever's supplying it, that their names would be a matter of public record, so it would be pretty easy to find out who's doing it. So which pharmacies are going to want to step up to the plate next to be like, okay, oh yeah, we'll like step into the death penalty debate. This seems like a real front in the death penalty because, you know, a way to stop executions potentially because, you know, we were running short of the drugs for a long, long time. And, you know, obviously you can't execute someone if you don't have the drug. So this could be, you know, this could be a serious problem for the state.
So it is a new front. And, you know, one of the interesting things here is that there's an elegant solution for the state, which is to do something that Georgia did, which is to make the source of the drugs exempt from public records laws, and say, well, you know, it's just going to be a secret, and you don't get to find out where they're coming from.
Is that likely to happen?
It's tied up in court right now. The law went into Georgia, went into effect just recently, the day before the guy was slated to be executed, and his execution was stayed because of this question of whether it was legal for them to keep the source of the drugs secret. But that could have an impact on state law here, too.
But as a practical matter, the legislature would have to do that, and
right,
they're not back until 2015.
Nothing's happening soon.
So we have a lot of scheduled executions probably until then.
Yeah.
That, I mean, they're going to have to find drugs for, I presume.
And it really is. I mean, it's just like anything around the death penalty. It's just so morbid and strange, this idea that, well, who knows how they're going to execute it. You know, the guy is suing because he's not sure how the state is going to put him to death. You know, and this pharmacist, this is another sort of like just kind of macabre, you know, wrinkle in this thing, but the pharmacist has a side business where he makes an anti-aging cream as well, and he has all kinds of other things like this that, you know, he doesn't want to be known as the guy who makes the death penalty drug here in Texas.
Well, and from there we go to a story about health insurance in Hidalgo County and beyond. Melissa, can you fill us in?
Sure, yeah. Last week I was down in the Rio Grande Valley in McAllen for the unveiling of the new federal health exchange, and you know, Hidalgo County is one of the most uninsured, has one of the highest uninsured rates in the nation. So they have a huge demand down there for health insurance. And so I visited a clinic down there, and there was just this huge outpouring of people waiting in line at 8 in the morning to get inside and find out more information about how they could get health insurance. And at the same time, there was a lot of confusion because the government shutdown started the same day. So people were enormously confused and calling the clinic and saying, hey, you know, is Obamacare shut down? Can we not get health insurance now because the government shut down? And so the clinic was on the phone telling people, no, you know, it's happening. Come on down and we'll help you find a health insurance plan. And, you know, people were really excited. I mean, they were thrilled that they might actually have health insurance after, you know, decades of living without it. So, of course, there were glitches. You know, the website kept crashing because of the demand. And so people were waiting, but they were patient and they were, you know, they hired 9 new people who were going to be there for a year, helping people sign up for health insurance. And the clinic I visited was called Nuestra Clínica del Valle, and they have 11 facilities in Starr and Hidalgo County, which are two of the most, you know, uninsured counties in the nation, Hidalgo and Starr County. And they see about 36,000 people a year in those clinics. And most of the people they see are working people. They just aren't offered insurance through their employer or they can't afford it. So, so it's just been a huge deal for them down there.
And Ted Cruz was down there not too long before that, right, on his, like, barnstorming tour, trying to encourage people not to sign up for Obamacare,
right,
and trying to convince people that they were actually better off not having health insurance.
Right, and that's what people were telling me down there. Here's the irony that the National Guard every year does a special project where they go down to the valley and they treat the uninsured, and they were there, I think, in July or August, and they had so much demand that they didn't have enough National Guard to help everybody. People were in line at 4 in the morning, like around the block, waiting just for dental and medical checkups. And I think it was the biggest demand they'd had in the years that they've been doing it now for several years. So they were overwhelmed. And then, you know, here comes Senator Cruz a month later at a $500 a table fundraiser, where the sole subject he wants to talk about is defunding Obamacare and how they all don't need health insurance down there, that they don't need this health exchange. So there were protesters outside the fundraiser. You know, people were just outraged that he's inside this fundraiser talking about how, you know, they should shut down the healthcare exchange. And then a month later, the healthcare exchange is rolled out, and it's the first day at one clinic, they had 75 people there signing up. So it's been a big success so far.
But to me, that's like the great disconnect, right, between what's going on in Texas, where as a state, we have the highest rate of uninsured in the country, and then look at some parts of the state where it's astronomical, like, you know, I talked about Hidalgo County, and yet it seems like it's our politicians, you know, it's the Texas delegation in D.C. that is like driving the defund Obamacare, shut down the government idea. I mean, Ted Cruz was the guy who was driving that train, and then in the congressional delegation, we have, I mean, many of the Tea Party people are Texas representatives. And I mean, we have one of the conservative, or I wouldn't even call it conservative, I call it radical, congressional delegations in the country opposed to Obamacare. And yet, here in the state, you know, Texans are perhaps the people that need it the most, or the people who will benefit the most from the exchanges, perhaps from a Medicaid expansion, and yet there seems to be this disconnect between what people need on the ground and what our politicians are saying and what the state leaders are saying. And I don't know how to explain that or what the resolution of that is, but it's kind of ironic that that's the case.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate too because it's created a lot of confusion in Texas. You know, people are confused. They were like, well, Senator Cruz says, you know, shut down the government, shut down Obamacare. So does that mean we can't sign up today for the health you know, the health insurance exchange.
Has Ted Cruz won yet?
Yeah, did Ted Cruz win? What's going on, you know? And then with Governor Perry coming out and saying, no, we're not going to have these health navigators. We're going to crack down on that, and there's going to be, you know, new certifications that they're going to have to qualify for. So some of the nonprofits down there pulled out of the navigator program because they thought it was going to be too stringent and they weren't sure really what the state was going to do, because Perry was making these pronouncements, you know, just a few days before the rollout. So there's been a lot of confusion. It's unfortunate because it prevents people from getting the health coverage that they really, really need. I mean, it's a life and death. Underneath all of this rhetoric, you know, it's a life and death situation for people. I mean, these are people's lives, and they shouldn't be just turning it into a political football like they are.
Well, thanks for sharing that story.
Sure.
Joining us now is freelance writer Maurice Shema, who lives in Austin. He recently wrote a long story for The Observer's October issue called The Recanters. Maurice, can you explain to us what this piece is about?
Sure. It's largely about a woman named Beverly Troup, who's in her mid-30s now, but in the 80s when she was a young child, she was taken to the hospital by her mother because she was complaining of some pain when she went to the bathroom. And thus began the sort of whole story, which the doctor concluded that she had been sexually assaulted. The investigation came to focus on her stepfather, a man named Brian Troup. And a few months after that, he was convicted of it. And she, you know, had said in an interview with a social worker that he had done it. But then, you know, over the years, she slowly came to realize that he had never done it, and she sort of switched the entire story and started telling whoever would listen that this had never actually happened to her. And then when she was an adult, she started turning that into a sort of formal effort to exonerate him. He spent 17 years in prison for allegedly assaulting her, and now is out on parole as a registered sex offender. And so the story is about her experience and his experience, and then the broader issue of child witnesses and the kind of problems that they create for a legal system that is, you know, most of the time assumes that an adult is telling the truth. So when somebody says, no, I was actually lying then, but I'm not lying now, it creates these problems. So I look at a couple other cases that are like hers and then use her as a sort of big example.
Well, in the case of her specific case, one of the things I found interesting is that when she recants, you know, it's like 20 years later, roughly, and a lot of the evidence that was used at the time, it can't be found, or it no longer exists, and I mean, that led to a lot of problems for her.
Right, I mean, she is on this ongoing struggle. She believes that the photographs of the original pediatric exam and the video of her interview with the social worker are out there and in this courthouse, and that the prosecutors are trying to hide it from her. The courthouse, the Bell County administrators have told her that this stuff doesn't exist anymore, and they've gone back and forth about that. And that evidence would be a real big key legally to introducing that as new evidence is really the thing that would get her stepfather some relief, because they filed an appeal several years ago, and it sort of went nowhere because the county was standing by the conviction, and there was really no new evidence that they could offer other than her recantation. So
what has life been like for her since she initially testified?
She spent 10 years in foster care. So this originally all happened when she was 8 years old, and then she spent the next 10 years bouncing around different foster homes, about a year in each, over 10 years. Had really horrible experiences in some of those foster homes. She told me that she was sexually assaulted in one of them and ran away, and then her mother came and picked her up, but then she was taken away again from the mother and put, you know, in a couple more foster homes throughout her teenage years. And then when she turned 18, as soon as she could, she moved back in with her mother, who actually had stayed with her stepfather this entire time, even as he went to prison. She is sort of a big character in the story as I've written it, but, you know, a whole story could be told about this woman who lost her daughter and her husband sort of around the same time, and the way that she's dealt with that. But Beverly is now in her mid-30s. She's very happily married and has basically, you know,
at peace with her life in certain ways, but spends a lot of her free time, maybe all of it, trying to find a way to exonerate her father. So,
what do you guys think?
Well, this is a really interesting story, and I'm kind of curious how you came across it in the mm-hmm. first place, and how you found Beverly.
Yeah, I found Beverly because there's a handful of cases like this that have been reported on in local newspapers. Her had not at all. But while I was doing research for a different story about a sort of sexual abuse wrongful conviction case, I attended a hearing in San Antonio that I read about a bit in the piece that was a very similar kind of case. It's one of those things where there aren't statistics, but now there are so many different anecdotes that it's starting to kind of build a broader picture of these kinds of cases. And it was at a hearing for a similar sort of case that a woman named Mary Sue Molnar, who works with an organization called Texas Voices for Reason and Justice. I believe they're a nonprofit that basically tries to support people who are registered sex offenders or have kinds of problems with the law in that way. Beverly had been in touch with her and calling her, and she came up to me and said, there's this woman, she's trying to recant, no one believes her, but it's a really interesting case of this if you're interested. And so I got in touch with Beverly and kind of went from there. I found that the story really couldn't have happened if she and her parents hadn't been so incredibly generous with their time. I mean, she clearly spends so much time on this that anytime I would send her an email just checking a fact or asking a quick question, she would get back to me so quickly. And when we met, she handed me this big file folder with all sorts of information. It was not the kind of case where you were dealing with a really reticent journalistic subject. I mean, she was really eager to get this story out there in whatever way. So,
I was curious about what could be done, if anything, to try to address these kinds of cases where there are, you know, allegedly wrongful convictions for sexual assault of a child. I mean, her case is so amazing because, you know, this started, as you write in the story, with she went to her mother and said that it hurt when she urinated, and they went to the hospital, and that led to an examination, and that's how it all started. Mm-hmm. And that led to the state wrongly convicting or seemingly wrongly convicting Brian and then taking Beverly away from her parents, which led to her actually being assaulted. I mean, it's an extraordinary example of the power of the state. Mm-hmm. And yet on the other side, we have these cases we all hear about where there are allegations of child abuse that aren't followed through on, and the state doesn't do enough, and there's tragedies that come from that as well. So it's a very, and the people that led to the conviction of Brian and took Beverly away, I mean, they were acting because they thought they were protecting children. So they seemingly were acting out of good motives. I mean, it seems like a very difficult area.
Yeah.
What can be done here? Is there anything to be done policy-wise to kind of address these?
Yeah, I mean, what I found so interesting about the story was that in a lot of these cases where some horrible injustice has occurred, you would want there to be some individual evil actor. And in this case, it really isn't that way, because the people who believed that Brian had abused Beverly, in spite of her protestations that he had not, seem to be acting, you know, in the child's interest. And so it seems like there are two policy questions. The one is, in cases where this happened a long time ago, because in the 80s and 90s, you know, there were all kinds of cases like this, and now people are adults, there's the policy question of how to deal with wrongful convictions or possible wrongful convictions that happened in the deep past, and then there's the question of contemporary CPS workers. If this happened today and a girl went to the hospital, how would it be handled differently? I think for the second question, just the benefit of time and progress has helped a bit. I mean, it's hard to know if 20 years from now we're going to hear about another Beverly Troop, but one of the things I found most shocking and strange about the story was that the social worker was so young. She was in her early 20s. The doctor, I think, was 29 years old. I mean, we're talking some very young people who have been given a tremendous amount of power, and I think that I would like to think that these days there's a bit more checks and balances in terms of you know, oversight by other doctors and boards of nurses. There are plenty of advocates for the wrongfully convicted who would say not enough has changed. There's plenty of people in the child advocacy community who would say tons has changed. Both sides see their own side as losing. I think that's the nature of this sort of problem. As far as cases from 20 years ago, the Texas legislature actually passed into law this past session a bill, I don't remember the number offhand, but it basically created a more clear legal pathway for cases in which the science has fundamentally changed. Or, you know, if you can get a doctor to say, the science was this way in the mid-80s and it is this way now, and as a result, a jury would not have convicted because I would not have gotten on the stand today and said what I did in the mid-80s, I think you would see, I think that there's a very positive possibility that that's going to change things. That went into effect on September 1st, so it's really, really too soon to tell whether that's going to actually affect some of these cases, but it certainly opens a pathway because for years and years, there were cases that the Court of Criminal Appeals wouldn't look at or threw out because there was no kind of law handed down by the legislature about the role of changing science in these legal cases. So.
There's one case you talk about where this bizarre test that I'd never even heard of before was used, and it was like flashing pictures of women.
Yeah, I came across that in, was that the Arena case? Out of Bell County. Yeah, there was, that is its own kind of whole saga, and Jordan Smith at the Austin Chronicle has done a ton of reporting on it. But there was a test used, I don't know how often, but certainly one psychologist who testified in many of these cases used this test where he would put the defendant or the suspected pedophile in front of a computer screen and show them images of women of varying ages, and they would just be told, oh, click through the slideshow, but it would secretly measure how long they lingered on each picture. And it, you know, if they lingered too long on a picture of a young child, it would be seen as some sort of indication that they have pedophilic tendencies. And this cast in a lot of the kinds of tests that you hear about pedophilia that were common in the 80s and 90s, you know, in the era of those big satanic ritual abuse cases. A lot of those tests today sound completely ridiculous, but you can imagine at the time they might have had a certain intuitive appeal. I was an adult in the 80s, so I don't know what it was like at the time. I certainly was not a psychologist in the 80s, so I really don't know what the state of that field was at the time, and don't have a real intuitive grasp of it, but there's a lot of tests like that that today just seem, I mean, I think the one of the justices of the Texas Supreme Court referred to that test as bordering on hokum. I mean, today it just sounds so absurd. But this was a time, I mean, Beverly's case was at a time when a lot of these satanic ritual abuse cases were happening and not a lot of activists or journalists had come out yet really questioning these cases in the way that Debbie Nathan, who was at the Texas Observer for a long time, and other journalists would later question them. So, I mean, the whole state of the field, both law and medicine at the time, were very different.
Excellent. Well, thanks for sharing your story with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You can read Maurice Chamas' story, The Recanters, on TexasObserver.org.
Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our show, but other episodes of Observer Radio are available for your listening pleasure at TexasObserver.org. Before we go, I would like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our intro and outro music. And of course, I'd also like to thank you for listening. We'll be back to talk at you later on Observer Radio.